afternoon, and welcome to episode 111 of the Political Mike podcast. According to a recent analysis by Open Secrets, the 2022 federal election shattered records, costing more than $8.9 billion. That's a staggering increase compared to the inflation-adjusted $7.1 billion spent on the 2018 midterm elections. Despite this astronomical spending, the outcomes of the 2022 election did not match the financial investment. Democrats only managed to pick one U.S. Senate seat, and even that majority became narrower when Senator Sinema switched from Democrat to independent. On the other hand, Republicans narrowly regained a five-member majority in the House of Representatives, causing political changes for House Speaker Kevin McCarthy. Spending data from Ad Impact shows how the various White House contenders for the 2024 Republican presidential nomination have different strategies for the early primary map, investing resources in the states and messages that they hope can serve as launching pads to the nomination, spending nearly $70 million along the way. Allies of former President Donald Trump, the frontrunner for the GOP nomination, have taken a unique approach among the crowded field, devoting more than three quarters of their ad spending dollars to national cable advertising, and MAGA Incorporated, the super PAC backing this campaign, has spent $15.7 million on national cable advertising out of a total of nearly $20 million in ad spending so far. The pro-Trump group has split the rest of its spending, a little more than $4 million between Iowa and New Hampshire. Reflecting that strategy between May and June, MAGA Incorporated spent $1.6 million on an ad running in major media markets, Los Angeles, New York City, Washington, D.C., and Philadelphia, which criticizes the former president's indictment in the classified documents case. The super PAC has also kept ads attacking his major Republican opponent, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, in rotation in the early primary states. There are also hints at the strategy of DeSantis' camp and the ad spending of a super PAC backing his campaign, Never Back Down. The group has spent a total of about $15.5 million on advertising so far, directing $4.3 million to Iowa and $3.7 million to South Carolina. The group launched a new TV spot in Iowa proclaiming that DeSantis was waging a war on woke and winning. By contrast, the group has spent just $1.3 million in New Hampshire so far. And notably, Never Back Down has spent about $630,000 in Nevada, another early voting state. North Dakota's governor, Doug Burgum, has emerged as a top advertiser in New Hampshire so far as well, spending more than $2.1 million in the state as an independently wealthy candidate works to raise his profile among voters. Joining me today is Professor Lawrence Lessig, Harvard Law professor and author. Professor Lessig's work in the field of campaign finance reform has been groundbreaking and influential. With a deep commitment to addressing the coercive influence of money in politics, he has dedicated years to studying the intricate relationship between campaign finance practices and the health of our democracy. Throughout his research and advocacy, Professor Lessig has shed light on the ways in which campaign financing distorts our electoral system, often sidelining the voices of ordinary citizens. He has been a leading voice in raising awareness about the need for comprehensive campaign finance reform and has championed policies that aim to reduce the undue influence of wealthy individuals and special interest groups since the Supreme Court's 2010 Citizens United decision. He is the author of the book, They Don't Represent Us, Reclaiming Our Democracy, in which he presents a compelling case for reform. And he offers thought-provoking arguments and practical solutions to address the disparities between the interests of the people and the actions of elected representatives. Professor Lessig, thank you for being part of the Political Mike podcast today.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
So the first question I want to ask you, Professor, is, you know, can you briefly describe some of the key strategies on policy changes that you believe are crucial for achieving comprehensive campaign finance reform?
Yeah, you know, I think it's really important to understand what is the problem with money in politics. Many people think the problem is unequal spending. I don't think that's the problem. Many people think there's too much money in politics. I don't think that's the problem. The problem with money in politics is the candidate's dependency on an ever-shrinking number of extraordinarily wealthy people. The number of families who participate and fund campaigns is shrinking so that a smaller number of Americans basically get to call the shots, not just in presidential races, but across the full range of federal elections. So the critical thing is to change that corrupting dependence on this tiny number of people funding campaigns. So the number one change that could do that is to change the way we fund campaigns. Seattle has experimented they've had three election cycles with this, and they're having their fourth right now, with something called democracy vouchers, where every single voter gets four democracy vouchers, which they can use to give to candidates to fund their campaigns. And what that's done is radically increase the number of people who are participating in the funding of campaigns, so that the representatives are concerned to represent the full range of people in their district, not just the tiny fraction of the 1% who are going to give money in large bundles to their campaign. So that, I think, is the most important change. But I actually think the change that we could achieve in a very short period of time is to recognize the power of legislatures and Congress to limit contributions to these so-called super PACs. Now, the reason there are super PACs today is that the DC Circuit Court of Appeals, 13 years ago, 3 months after Citizens United, said that if Citizens United said the First Amendment protects a candidate, a person, corporation, individual, union, PAC, from spending unlimited amounts of money to promote a candidate or oppose a candidate, so long as it's independent of that candidate, because that's protected by the First Amendment, the DC Circuit said it must be that contributions to an independent political action committee are also protected by the First Amendment. That decision was never appealed to the Supreme Court. A bunch of other courts followed it very quickly. So among lawyers, that's settled law. But that is just logically and absolutely clearly a mistake in its conclusion. And so what I think we could do very shortly, very quickly, is tee up a case that actually establishes that, in fact, super PACs are not constitutionally required, and get that to the Supreme Court. And I predict that the Supreme Court, 7-2, will uphold the power of states and Congress to regulate and limit super PACs. And if they do that, a law that's already on the books would come back to life, like from the dead, the way that the abortion laws came back to life after the Dobbs decision. And super PACs would be rendered illegal in the United States. And that would fundamentally change the dynamics of how these candidates are raising money. I think that's something we could accomplish very easily.
So you've expressed hope in this current Supreme Court being able to restore, you know, some semblance of true democracy as it pertains to addressing campaign finance reform. Now, what do you say to those critics who, you know, look at recent Supreme Court rulings, not just Dobbs, but the decision to strike down President Biden's student loan forgiveness program, and also to eradicate affirmative action in the realm of admissions decisions for higher education, and say, well, how could we have any kind of expectancy of any progress on this front since there's been, you know, regress in these other areas of public policy?
Yeah, I mean, I completely understand the cynicism, skepticism people have about this court. From 50,000 feet, it does look like a court that's behaving extremely politically. And I do think they're behaving in an extremely activist way, meaning they're being very aggressive in bringing about changes to the law that they think follow from their own principle or their own conception of what the Constitution means. So I get the cynicism. But the argument that would be deployed to defend the regulation of super PACs is the most conservative, narrow argument about campaign finance regulation. It's Chief Justice Roberts himself who has said that you can regulate contributions to candidates or to committees only so far as you can demonstrate the risk of quid pro quo corruption. And so the question in the context of super PACs is whether you can demonstrate the risk of quid pro quo corruption, this for that corruption. Now, when the DC Circuit decided the case in 2010, it was imagining a contributor talking to a super PAC. And it said there could be no corruption there because they're not talking to the candidate. The only way you have corruption is if you're talking to the candidate. What they didn't think about was a case that the government actually prosecuted, United States versus Menendez. Senator Robert Menendez was charged with coordinating with a donor. And the donor said to Menendez, allegedly, I'll give a bunch of money to a super PAC that will support you if you'll help me in the following ways with the government. That's classic quid pro quo corruption. That is as illegal as anything could be. Now, they didn't succeed in convicting Menendez because the jury didn't believe the facts. But the point is, even though it's a contribution to a independent political action committee, it still involved quid pro quo corruption. So my view is, when this case gets to the Supreme Court, and this issue has never gotten to the Supreme Court, when it gets to the Supreme Court, the conservatives on the Supreme Court, applying their extremely narrow test, only quid pro quo corruption, will have it'd be very difficult for them to say, oh, okay, only in quid pro quo corruption, but not here. So I think it's clear that they would uphold regulation of super PACs because they will see that there's a kind of interference that the D.C. Circuit was not thinking of. Now, it's possible that the Supreme Court would say, oh, yeah, no regulations of campaign money are allowed. You can't even limit direct donations. It's possible. They could be that crazy. But I think that's not likely. I think what's going to happen is that when this case gets to the Supreme Court, the court's going to rule almost unanimously that super PACs are not constitutionally required. And then we lawyers are going to be extremely embarrassed that for 13 freaking years, I mean, it's going to take at least 2 years to get to the court. So 15 freaking years, we've had this poison in our political system, and there's no reason for it. There's no reason this had to be here. And yet the distortions that have been created, even at the Supreme Court, I mean, it was super PACs that were standing behind many of the appointments that we've recently seen, and certainly many in the context of driving appointments in the lower federal court. So it's just really embarrassing that we're here when I think it's absolutely clear that there's no way that the court is going to rule against us.
Professor Lessig, you ran in the 2016 Democratic primary. In the current primary for the Republican nomination, the RNC has, of course, impose some criteria that the candidates have to meet in order to get on the debate stage on August 23rd. Those criteria include reaching a 1% mark in national polls, and also having at least 40,000 individual donors, with at least 200 donors in 20 different states. And of course, there's the pledge to support the eventual nominee. As a former candidate for president, what are your thoughts about the criteria to get at least 40,000 individual donors, and within those donors have at least 200 donors in 20 different states? Do you believe that this proposal by the RNC would help hinder the entry of grassroots campaigns? Or do you believe that this would actually help strike a balance between ensuring a fair and inclusive process while maintaining the party standards for participation?
I actually think that the donor participation measure is a pretty good one. It can be gamed. So the North Dakota governor is gaming it by basically giving everybody a $20 gift certificate, gift card, if they donate as little as $1. So it's, you know, kind of a racket to get the number of donations that he needs. But I think that donations, small donations especially, are a pretty good measure of something important, much better than just relying on polling numbers alone. Now, when I tried to become a candidate in 2016, I wanted to be a candidate because I wanted to put this issue of the corrupting influence of money or the corruption of our democracy at the center of the debate. I wanted to show how every single issue we talked about, whether it's climate change regulation or the crazy defense spending that we have, or student loans or healthcare, all of these issues were rendered impossible for us to solve in a sensible way because of the corrupting influence of money. So if you want to solve any of those issues, you got to solve the money issue first. That's the issue I wanted to put at the center of the debate. And you know, what happens is something none of us expected would happen, is that when we got close to actually qualifying for the debate, DNC called my campaign manager and said, actually, we're going to modify the rules. And so now you don't qualify for the debate. And, understand you're never going to qualify for the debate. We're never going to basically allow you to be in the debate. So I would say with the RNC, okay, those are rules. I think it's not, I don't think it's a terrible thing to say you need 40,000 people in a country of 350 million who are willing to send you $5 to be able to be part of the nomination process. And 1% depends on which polls you're including, because polls are really pretty corrosive right now, given the diversity of techniques, but it depends on which polls you're including. It doesn't seem to me that's terrible, as long as they're transparent and they don't move the goal line when they finally get to a place that they're deciding who they're going to invite.
So, Professor Lessig, what lessons can we learn from the 2022 midterm elections? in terms of the effectiveness of campaign spending and its impact on the electoral outcomes?
Well, I mean, you know, nothing in 2022 fundamentally changes the truth the political sciences have been talking about for the last 50 years, that in general, the person who spends more is more likely to win. I mean, there are exceptions. And so money is not the only thing that decides whether you're going to win or not. But I do think it's important to recognize that 2022 also demonstrated the continued growth in super PACs as the critical funder of choice. And increasingly, in competitive races, the super PACs are spending more than the candidates themselves. And their campaigns are essentially outsourced to the super PACs. So basically, all of the limits that we've built into the campaign finance system that says you can only give 5,400, maybe 5,700 in this election cycle, are meaningless, because I might be limited to give $5,400, but if I'm a billionaire, I can give the super PAC that supports you $1 billion. Indeed, we saw one contribution of $1.6 billion to one of these independent political action committees. $1.6 billion from one person. And that is the dynamic of an increasingly small number of people who are the most relevant people for politics. That's a deep destruction, a corruption of a representative democracy. Madison told us we would have a democracy where, quote, the government would be, quote, dependent on the people alone. And he said by the people, he meant, quote, not the rich more than the poor. Now, of course, he did mean men and not women. And of course, African-Americans were not included anywhere in that equation. But the point is, for those who counted, it was supposed to be representative dependence on everybody, not the rich more than the poor. We have evolved a system where our politicians are dependent, number one, on the super rich, on the people who are funding their campaigns. If they don't get past the funding primary, it doesn't matter. They're not going to have a chance to run in the general primary. So, you know, I'm sure you've talked about on this show, you know, for many years in the South, states like Texas had a white primary. The only people who could vote in the Democratic Party were white people. And after the white primary, of course, then you could anybody could vote in the general election. That was governed by the 15th Amendment. But the primary was thought to be private. And so the Democratic Party was allowed to have just white people vote in the white primary. Well, what that did, obviously, was produce a party that was bending over backwards to care about the interests white people wanted and didn't care at all about the interests that might affect black people. Well, that's the same thing with the money primary. When the only people who can win are the people who can be attractive to the super wealthy, then fine, those people will be nominated. And then we're going to have an election, a general election, where the only issues that matter are the issues that the super wealthy are interested in. And that describes our democracy right now.
So what is your response to those who, you know, may support groups like Americans for Prosperity, which is a political action committee that was started by, you know, the Koch network, the Koch brothers network? You have this political network established by the conservative industrialists Charles and David Koch, raising over $70 million for political races as it looks to help Republicans move past Donald J. Trump, who many view as a threat to American democracy. You know, two groups that are closely affiliated with Charles Koch contributed $50 million of the more than $70 million that has been raised. And Mr. Koch, of course, is a major shareholder in Koch Industries, which contributed $25 million to Americans for Prosperity. What is your response to those who say, well, we could actually use political action committees for good in terms of getting rid of Donald Trump and turning the page and having a nominee that would actually not have federal indictments over his head and would respect the rule of law and abide by the Constitution? What is your response to that?
Well, there's no doubt you could have a super PAC that's doing good. You know, in 2014, I set up a super PAC to end super PACs. I thought that was pretty good. I thought the objective there was a good democratic objective. And, you know, there have been super PACs that have spent money for the environment and for bringing about change in the way we have healthcare in America. So it's not the point. The point is not that every super PAC is evil. The point is a democracy that is dependent on a tiny number of people is not a democracy. So if we have a political system where, you know, 150 families are giving 70% of the money that is determining the elections in America, that is a banana republic. It's not a democracy. It's not a representative democracy. And so even though there's good big money, there's bad big money, but whether it's good or bad is not the issue for me. The question is whether our representatives are dependent on all of us, the rich, no more than the poor. And that's obviously not the kind of representative democracy we have right now.
So, Professor, you know, some argue, of course, as it pertains to the solution to campaign finance reform. You know, when discussing campaign finance reform, many argue that public financing of elections is the solution. Others argue in favor of stricter regulations on political donations. What are your thoughts on these approaches? And how can we ensure that any reforms are effective in combating the influence of money in politics?
Yeah, so it depends, again, what you think the negative influence is. And so my view of the negative influence is a system that is dependent upon a small number of people. So the solution to that problem is to increase the number of people who are contributing to campaigns. And the most effective way to do that is through a voucher system. So basically, you give every voter a number of vouchers. Seattle has 4 vouchers each worth $25, but you know, can imagine $500 worth of vouchers that every voter gets. And then they get to hand those out to candidates. And what that would do immediately is change the dynamic of fundraising. You won't have candidates sitting in a cubicle spending 30 to 70% of their time raising money. Instead, you'll have them out on the hustings, raising money from ordinary people or running block parties or barbecues where people come and hand them their vouchers. So the point is, this would make the politicians dependent on the most number of voters that you could in the funding stage. And then when you get to the election stage, the one that wins is the one that gets the most number of votes from the voters. But the point is, the system would drive the attention of the politician towards the average voter, not towards the tiny fraction of funders. That, I think, is the critical change that needs to be needed. There are other forms of public funding. You know, presidential public funding basically has a matching system and to qualify. But once you qualify, they basically write a big check. And both parties used this until Barack Obama backed out in 2008. So every president elected between Nixon and Obama had used presidential public funding. No one was better benefited from this than Ronald Reagan, who in 1976 came very close to displacing the party nominee on the backs of presidential public funding. But the problem with presidential public funding model is that it's still removed from the people. Like, you get a check, you don't have to raise money anymore, but you also don't have to do anything with your voter. And I think a better system is a system where the candidate has an ongoing interest to connect to ordinary people in the political process. And there are two critical stages. One is the process of raising until the election, as the second is election day. And those are two moments when ordinary voices could affect what our politicians cared about, rather than the system right now, where the politicians who get there are the politicians who made money happy. And once money was happy, then they got to run for their election. And among those people who made money happy, we get to pick. But there's no difference between a Democrat who is who's in bed with big money and a Republican who's in bed with big money. They're both in bed with big money. And so the idea we are picking between the two is just crazy talk. We ought to have a system where nobody is dependent on big money. And then we can start arguing about which policies are good or not. Was national health care a good policy? Is student loan forgiveness a good policy? That's the kind of argument we should be able to have. And we can't have right now because of big money. And the biggest place we can't have that argument is in the context of defense or Empire America. The amount of money we have spent to make the world unsafe is astonishing. And the amount of money we've lost as a nation because of infrastructure that we've not been able to build because we've been spending all our money on bombers and tanks and all this ridiculousness is astonishing. But we only do this because both parties are in bed with the funders that are supporting the defense industry. And until we break the connection between money and elections, we're not going to be able to escape the corruption of Empire America. And that, I think, is the greatest problem that we as a country face. And the reason that most of the world looks at us and says, you guys are a pretty dangerous influence in the world, and we need to figure a way to tamp you down.
You know, you made me think about Ross Perot in 1992, who I think was, you know, I guess before, you know, Theodore Roosevelt's third party bid in 1912, he was someone who had a serious challenge. He raised a serious challenge to the two-party system. And a large part of his appeal was in the fact that he was a self-funded candidate who was accountable to the people. He was not bought by any political action committee, or he was not bought by any large donor or anything like that. And then fast forward to 2016, and the two candidates that seemed to get a lot of buzz and attention were Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. And even though they both respectively had attached themselves to a political party machine, for the most part, they were very much independent. Bernie Sanders had registered as a Democrat to run. He's an independent senator from Vermont. Donald Trump, of course, was a Democrat registered in New York City for many years before switching his party affiliation and deciding to run in 2015. Do you believe that any serious push for campaign finance reform would have to come from an independent movement to the two-party system?
Well, I mean, the reality of the math in the Electoral College for electing the president is that there's no independent path to electing the president. There's a bunch of fantasy talk happening right now with the No Labels group, which is putting together a plan for a third-party candidate. But it's fantasy talk. It's extremely dangerous fantasy talk, because the winner-take-all system that exists in the states requires a two-party process to get anything close to a majority candidate, a candidate that represents the actual majority of the people. Now, we could have a different system. We could have like ranked choice voting in the states, and we could allocate electors proportionally. And if we did, I'd be all in favor of third-party candidates, because I think then that would get us close to a more competitive field where the winner actually represents the will of a majority, and that winner could easily be somebody who's not a Republican or not a Democrat. But right now, under the system we have right now, there's no way to achieve that. So how do we get reform? Well, we could get reform if you imagine a bunch of representatives in Congress. Let's say like the difference between the majority and the minority is like 50, if it were something like 10 members of the House. Imagine 20 members of the House, 10 Democrats, 10 Republicans, created their own caucus. And they said, we're never going to support a candidate for speaker unless that speaker promises us that fundamental reform will be enacted. If it is, we'll support that speaker. If it isn't, we're not going to support the speaker. So the point is, you could imagine a faction, cross-party faction, that was big enough to actually force reform through the House and through the Senate. And I think that actually is a strategy that is quite stable. It's not going to throw the government into craziness, but would deliver reform if you had the willingness of enough people to join behind that. And you could have a presidential candidate who was tied to that very idea, who said, I'm going to make sure that this reform faction actually achieves their objective, and we're going to deliver reform in the first 100 days of an administration. That's a path I think is sensible. But the idea of electing an independent is just driven by either willfulness or just ignorance about how the system functions.
And what about efforts or arguments in favor of abolishing the electoral college system? Do you see that in tandem with the goal of having more accountability as it pertains to money in politics?
Well, I mean, the electoral college system is terrible right now because of winner-take-all in the states. And the reason that's terrible is that winner-take-all means that it's only about, this time it'll be about 9 states that are competitive, which means that candidates for president focus all of their attention on those 9 states. And so they care about the issues those 9 states care about. They don't care about the issues the other 42, counting DC, care about. And the reason that's a problem is those 9 states don't represent America. They're older, they're whiter, their industry is more kind of 20th century industry, not 21st century industry. So the idea that the president is bending his or her policies to satisfy these 9 states is just crazy in a nation of 50 states plus the District of Columbia. So many people want to abolish the Electoral College. I'm all in favor of abolishing the Electoral College, going to a direct popular vote. I don't think politically that's feasible right now, because I think the Republican Party thinks the only way they win is through the Electoral College. So there is a change in the way the Electoral College allocates electoral votes that could actually improve the system dramatically. And that would be if each state allocated their electoral votes proportionally. I mean, you know, all the way down to the decimals. So if I get 37, if a candidate got 37% of the vote in a state, they got 37% of the electors exactly. And what that would mean is that every single state is now in play. And it makes sense for me as a candidate to go to Kentucky or to go to Utah as much as it goes to New York or to California, states that right now no candidate, whether Republican or Democrat, would spend any time campaigning in. That change would still give lots of extra weight to the small states. But the interesting thing about the small states is that they're evenly divided between red and blue. There are five, you know, the bottom 10 states, there are five red, five blue. So it benefits small states, but small states are not partisan or don't pull it to one direction or the other. So it's a compromise that keeps us in the Electoral College system, but would change the number one problem with the Electoral College system, which is that most of us don't matter to the election of the president. It's only these people in these swing states.
In recent years, you know, in addition to the rise and prominence of super PACs, we've also witnessed the rise of dark money. How can we address the issue of undisclosed money in our political system and increase transparency in campaign finance?
Well, I mean, that's a pretty easy problem to solve if we had any political will, because the only reason there's dark money is that there's a loophole in the disclosure obligations related to organizations called C4 organizations. So those are nonprofit entities that are doing political work. And so the way that loophole works is that a super PAC must disclose everybody who donates to the super PAC. So if you give a super PAC $1 million, your name is on the super PAC's disclosure form. But if a C4 gives money to a super PAC, all that's on the super PAC's disclosure form is the name of the C4. And the C4 itself has no obligation to disclose its donors. So dark money gets into our system because people give the C4 a bunch of money, and then the C4 gives the money to the super PAC, and they themselves have never been revealed in the process of giving money. That could be solved overnight if the IRS changes the rules about the disclosure obligations that C4 organizations have. And Congress has had bills, and they've been part of the efforts to reform that would force that transparency into the system, but those bills have not passed. And one of the reasons they've not passed is that this is one of those issues that both parties kind of like, because dark money is Democrat as much as it's Republican. In fact, Democrats spent more super PAC dark money in 2020 than Republicans did. And so you can see how, you know, in the short term, both parties would say, no, we don't want to change this rule. But I think people have got to recognize that America looks at our political system and thinks this is a deeply, deeply corrupt system, and for good reason. And so the only way we can address that deep loss in confidence in our political process is to reform it. And so transparency is an important part of the reform, but I don't think it's the most important. The most important is to change the way we fund campaigns. So vouchers is that change, and to end the possibility of super PACs. And I think if we could just get a case to the Supreme Court, those super PACs would be finished.
So the influence of money in politics is not limited to federal elections. It also affects state and local races as well. How can we ensure that campaign finance reform efforts address all levels of government and lead to more equitable representation across the board?
Well, here's where the rule about super PACs is particularly corrosive at the state level, because, you know, the rule about super PACs is thought to be a First Amendment rule, so it binds states as much as it binds Congress. And that means states don't have the ability to block large donations. And typically those large donations to independent political action committees are out of state. So we had a case in Alaska where we were trying to get the Alaska Supreme Court to recognize the flaw in the reasoning that created super PACs. They didn't do it. But in that case, we were able to demonstrate the extraordinary amount of outside money that has been dumped into Alaska to affect Alaska ballot measures. And you're like, shouldn't a state be allowed to have members of the state make decisions about that state without the influence coming from outside the state? I mean, in the United States, the Supreme Court has upheld the ability of the United States government to block even legal immigrants from buying political ads that might try to affect an election. And the argument there is the only people who should be able to affect the election are the people who are within the democracy, the voters. Well, why doesn't that apply at the level of the state? And And so the consequence of the super PAC rule is that states find themselves beleaguered in these campaigns where they're fighting not just within the state to get people in the state to want to do the right thing, but also this extraordinary amount of money from outside the state. The other place that this has been really poisonous is in the culture wars waged primarily at school boards. Like, it's astonishing the places where school board races become million-dollar races, to be on a school board. And that's because outside money, once again, comes in. They want to make a wokeness issue in a local school district, because that's, of course, what many in the Republican Party think their only issue is these days. And so they spend that money, they elect some crazy person who then, you know, makes this the fundamental issue. And there too, this only is possible because you've got this opportunity of funding through super PACs. And if we just change that and we said, you want to raise money to support your cause, go for it, but raise it from ordinary people with a cap. And so if you can raise $10 million, $5,000 a piece, then spend your $10 million. Go for it. That's what democracy is about. But the idea that somebody can walk in and write a check for $1.6 billion to make it so that conservative lawyers are on the federal bench and on the state Supreme Courts, that's not democracy. That's just complete corruption of the idea of representative democracy.
So in your view, Professor, what are the most significant obstacles or resistance to comprehensive campaign finance reform? And how can we overcome these challenges and build broad public support for change?
I think the biggest obstacle is people don't think it's possible. You know, we did a poll where we asked, how important is it to end the influence of big money in politics? 96% said that limiting the influence of big money in politics was important. And then we asked people, do you think it's possible? And only 5% thought it was possible. And so the point is that difference between the percentage you want something and the percentage who believes it's possible is the hopelessness gap. You know, you and I would love to be able to fly like Superman, but we don't jump off of tall buildings because we're pretty convinced we can't. But if you told me, like, you know, put this on your back and you can fly like Superman, I'd be the first guy to jump because I'd love to fly like Superman. So this is the same thing with this corrupting. Everybody gets it. Everybody sees it's a corrupt system. Everybody knows that in some sense it's corrupt on both sides. I mean, we should say the Democrats have been the only party that have pushed fundamental reform, and God bless them for that. Nancy Pelosi, the biggest fundraiser in the House, was the most aggressive person to push fundamental reform, taking the lead from John Sarbanes, who's architected it for the last decade. But we all know that this system affects both parties, and that leads us to think there's no way this will ever change. But if we could begin to see that change is possible, I think we unleash an enormous amount of energy to make change happen. So that's why I think, you know, just ending super PACs, which really just requires convincing lawyers that they've made a mistake. And it's not a hard mistake to make. Like, we're running a video competition. There's a $50,000 prize here. So like, if you're a listener and you could have any talent here, you could make $50,000 if you could, you do the winning video. The video basically takes the argument that demonstrates the mistake in the DC Circuit's case that gave us SuperX. Takes the argument, demonstrates the mistake, and the winning video will be the one that makes that most compellingly, convincingly clear to people that there is a mistake at the core of this doctrine. And so we're going to launch that in Labor Day, and the videos have to be in by Election Day, and then a series of judges will look at them and we'll find the one that makes this argument most clearly. But the objective here is to change conventional wisdom, to show people that in fact, we don't have to live with these corrupting things called super PACs. And if we win that, then I think we can begin to rebuild the extraordinary momentum that gave us the For the People Act and gave us, you know, came within one vote in the Senate to bring about the end of the filibuster to make it possible to pass that. We could revive that energy and maybe have a shot if we can convince people change here is possible. And my professional brand is pessimism, but I'm going to tell you, I'm optimistic that we're going to get the super PAC reform. And I'm really optimistic that if we get that, we can do everything else pretty quickly afterwards.
So one thing we haven't spoken about in detail was the removal of Section 5 from the Voting Rights Act. Earlier this year, the Supreme Court surprised a lot of folks on the left and the right, because the court found that the congressional map that was an issue likely violated Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act because it minimized the power of Black voters in the state of Alabama. Of course, many hailed this as progress and hope that we could probably have a restoration soon of Section 5. Do you think it's easier to get a restoration of Section 5? Or going back to what you were saying earlier, do you think it's easier to make a conservative originalist argument in favor against super PACs and thus getting one step closer towards eliminating big money in politics?
Well, you know, I think that the decisions interpreting the Voting Rights Act that have radically cut back on the scope of the Voting Rights Act, Shelby County, most importantly, are just flat out wrong. And I think those should be reversed. But I actually think that the strategy to build a movement for reform has to strike people as bigger than that. Now, that's not to say that the harm that's been done, especially to people of color because of these decisions, is insignificant. I don't think it's insignificant at all. Indeed, it's adding insult to injury, because the idea that in the 2020s, we're still fighting about practices designed to exclude people on the basis of race from voting is just ridiculous. It's outrageous. And yet that's reality. So I'm not minimizing the harm. But what I am saying is we need to build a big movement that includes people from every slice of life. And that was the strategy behind the For the People Act. You know, it had the John Lewis part of that bill was an extremely important voter empowerment law that basically said everybody has a right to vote, and you can't take that right away unless you got a really good reason. That would eliminate many of these barriers that exist right now to make it so people would vote. And so that part of the bill was appealing to those who've historically been excluded the most. And then there was a part of the bill that eliminated gerrymandering. And, you know, gerrymandering isn't something that affects African Americans alone. It affects, you know, everybody in America. And so it was appealing to another slice of America that's like disgusted with the political system. And it had a really ambitious public funding system for congressional campaigns. And there too, you know, it's not like everybody who cares about gerrymandering cares about public funding, but funding of campaigns. There's a whole bunch of people who look at the system and say, this is a deeply corrupt system. So the point is the strategy was to be as inclusive in the reform movement as possible, so that when we show up, we have people from every stripe of the reform movement who are standing together under the umbrella of that bill saying, hell yes, we have to pass this tomorrow. And so I think that's the kind of movement that we need to be advancing, one that's pushing that kind of comprehensive reform and be inclusive without diminishing the harm that any slice of the American public should be able to assert. So, you know, there are people in gerrymandered districts, Republicans in Democratic gerrymandered districts, Democrats in Republican gerrymandered districts, who have no effective representation. That's not as bad as not having any effective representation because of the color of your skin. That's insult to injury, but it's still injury. It's still, I have nobody to turn to because I'm a liberal in a conservative district, or I'm a conservative in a liberal district. We need to recognize that's a legitimate complaint, even if it's not a complaint tied to race. Or race is a legitimate complaint, even if it's not a complaint tied to the corruption caused by money. We need to be inclusive. And if we're inclusive, we can build a big enough movement to overcome the most important resistance to that movement, which is, I don't think the continued and revived racism of America. I think that's an important part, but I think we can crush that. The part that I'm worried about is money, because on the other side of this reform movement is all the money in the world. And they realize that if we had a representative democracy, they couldn't force America to continue to spend ungodly amounts of money on weapons of mass destruction. They couldn't force that anymore. They couldn't block us from achieving healthcare that actually was affordable and delivered healthy insurance for everybody. They couldn't block us from infrastructure reform, which gets blocked for all sort of stupid reasons to protect one interest over another. Point is, they couldn't block making America better. And so, you know, so much of their wealth depends on being able to block that. You know, I think here's like one example, which I think people don't remember anymore, but it's really important to reflect on. You know, until that 2010, Republican Party was as engaged in the climate change debate as the Democrats. John McCain thought he had a better plan for addressing climate change than Barack Obama. And they debated that. And I liked Obama's plan more than McCain, but I think McCain had a fair plan for addressing climate change. It was a fair move for Republicans and Democrats both to argue about which is the better way to address a commonly recognized problem. 2010, the Koch brothers made it known that if any Republican acknowledged the truth of climate change, you know, that humans had anything to do with climate change, if they acknowledged that, they would be primaried, meaning the Kochs would fund a candidate to run against them in the primary. And almost overnight, it became for Bolton in Republican circles to acknowledge the truth of climate change. And so we've now lived with 13 years of Republican denial of climate change, even though right now it becomes increasingly hard given the, you know, the fact that insurers are pulling out of Florida because they're not going to insure against these events anymore. You know, we in the Northeast are like suffering under Blade Runner-like cloud structures to make it seem like, you know, the world is coming to an end. All of this people get is related to climate change, but still the Republican Party is not going to put in their platform, assuming they have a platform this time, any connection to climate change because of the decision of these funders. Now, why did they think that was so important? Well, because they have all sorts of industries that would be burdened if we had effective climate regulation, and they didn't want that. So they were willing to spend ungodly amounts of money to protect their own industries. That's the corruption that we've got to find a way to end. And I think, you know, there are a lot of strategies that we got to pull together to make that happen, but this is the fight that we have to take. And the first easiest thing to do is to end the super PACs. And so I hope some of your listeners will enter the competition and then celebrate with me when they win the $50,000. I can't have any of the money, but I'm happy to go share a beer with somebody who wins when we finally get that done.
So Professor, as young people are becoming more engaged in politics, and I say that in light of the fact that, you know, Gen Z saw gains in terms of voter participation in the last election, the midterm of 2022. How can young people effectively empower and amplify their voices in shaping campaign finance reform?
Well, you know, I mean, the biggest issue with younger people is their belief that they don't actually need to participate. I mean, you know, in places like New Hampshire, it's harder for younger people to participate because of all sorts of ID requirements that I think violate the 27th Amendment, but whatever. It's hard for young people to participate in some contexts, but there's also the attitude that it doesn't matter if they don't participate. And I get in some districts, it's actually true, it doesn't matter whether they participate. But if they don't start participating at the levels that old people do, they're going to lose again and again. Indeed, we've done these simulations where you say, what if people 30 years or younger had voted at the level that people 65 years or older had voted? What if, like, elections since 1980 had been run like that? And overwhelmingly, you would have seen a massive shift away from the control the Republican Party has had into control by people who actually care about the future. I mean, you know, what is climate change except a way for us to tax our children? Because, you know, I'm never going to see the devastating effects of climate change. You know, I've got, you know, 20 years more and that's it. I'm gone. But you're going to be facing the devastating effects of climate change because we did not govern. Same thing with the debt. Like, you know, the debt is us borrowing from you. Thank you very much. And, you know, unlike the debt that was built after, you know, the Second World War, which was to stop fascism in Europe and Japan, and then built, in the infrastructure that was built in the 50s and the 60s, we didn't build any infrastructure that we're going to give you. Like, we just spent it on ourselves, tax cuts on ourselves, spending for weapons of mass destruction across the world, all this stuff. That's what we spent it on. And now you have to pay the debt. And so the point is, like, nobody's asking for super high participation. Just participate as much as the boomers. And if you're not willing to participate as much as the boomers, then, you know, maybe you deserve what you get, because this is a democracy and you win if you show up. Now, I understand people will resist that, but the reality is we boomers are going to win because you don't show up. And if we don't find a way to get people to make that clear and to bring people out, then again and again, the cynical, old, and basically white part of America is going to leverage their power to do what they want, regardless of what it does to you.
So looking ahead to the future, what do you envision as the future of campaign finance reforms? And are there any trends, emerging trends, or innovative approaches that give you hope for a more equitable and representative democracy?
Yeah, there's a lot of things happening at the state level, especially public funding innovations. I think we're seeing a lot of interest in the voucher solution at the state level. We had vouchers adopted in Oakland, though the mayor of Oakland has now exempted that from the budget, so it's not going to be paid for, which is a real outrage. LA will probably adopt vouchers. And so I think to the extent you start seeing lots of these local districts adopting this alternative way of funding, and we see the consequence of that, then we're going to see that spreading across the states. And one of the most important consequences people were not anticipating, I certainly was not anticipating, is that if you are in a voucher state or district and you use your voucher, you're more likely to turn out to vote. And that's pretty important. Like, we spend a lot of money trying to get people to turn out to vote. This might be a really cheap way to get them to turn out to vote, because it turns out that if you've like committed yourself with an investment, even an investment with, you know, basically fake money, because a voucher, you can't do anything else with it. So it's not like it's really taking anything from you to give it to a candidate or not. But if you give it to that candidate, even that fake money you give to the candidate, you now feel invested in the process. You're now more likely to go out and vote. So I think innovations like that begin to build back a healthier democracy at the state and local level. And when we get it at the state and local level, then people at the national level are going to begin to demand that we have the same level of representation when we think about Congress.
So Professor Lessig, before I let you go, could you elaborate on that contest that you alluded to a little bit?
Yeah, so if you go to our site, equalcitizens.us, you can see the campaign that we've launched for the video prize. So we first crowdfunded a $50,000 prize, and we've now committed that the first prize will be at least $50,000. We're going to continue to raise money for more prizes and maybe even a bigger prize. And then beginning on Labor Day, people can begin to submit their videos. And so there's the instructions right now are in basically outlined form, but the STEM file that you should watch that makes the argument in a very detailed way. You know, it's like endlessly long, 12 minutes long, which of course is wildly too long for the internet. But the point is, you listen to that 12-minute file, there'll be a certain point to which you say, oh my gosh, aha, I get it. This is ridiculous. This is an obvious mistake. And once you see that, then we're looking for people to think, okay, what's the most creative way that I can show that mistake? And then we want, you know, hundreds of videos that try to do that, so that it becomes kind of conventional understanding, especially among lawyers, that this decision that's been with us for 13 years is just wrong, just flat out wrong. Not wrong as a matter of policy, which, of course, I also believe, like, it's a terrible thing that we have super PACs, but wrong as a matter of conservative legal reasoning, like, wrong from the perspective of Chief Justice Roberts. And so if you make a video, whatever form, you know, you could do a rant on TikTok, you could do animation, you could do some clever graphics, you could use an AI to generate an AI video, you could do an play acting, like whatever you want to do, make that video, make it compelling, make it short, then you have a chance to win. And I'm very eager to see the video that wins the $50,000 prize.
Well, Professor Lessig, it's been a privilege and honor to have you on the platform. I thoroughly enjoyed this very informative discussion on campaign finance reform. And again, the name of your book, They Don't Represent Us, excellent read. And I encourage all the viewers to go and check it out. Thank you so much, Professor Lessig, for what you brought to episode 111 of the Political Mike Podcast.
Thanks, Mike.
With that being said, that concludes episode 111 of the Political Mike Podcast. Thank you all so much.
Hi, it's Mike Taylor, the host of the Political Mike Podcast. If you like what you heard tonight, I want to invite you to subscribe to our YouTube channel. I also want to ask you to please follow along on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, and Amazon Music. You can also follow along and keep up with the conversation through our Telegram channel. Follow us on Twitter at ThePolyMike, and follow us on Instagram. Thank you so much, and no matter what part of the political spectrum that you fall on, I want to encourage you to stay engaged, stay a part of the conversation, and stay informed. Thank you.